Well, good morning, everybody. How are you? Are you sure? I believe there's a direct correlation between feeling good and energy. So I'm going to make it a little darker so you can fall asleep. And then I'll call you out for it. I believe today is Maddie's mom's last day. She's been in town visiting, right, Crystal? And so far be it for us not to leave, have you leave with a treat. It was, as many of us know, it was from our conference drawn, our anniversary service. And so we are using this to infiltrate the land across Canada and into the States. Exactly. You'll have drawn on the front. People say, what is that about? And so, and then you've got Hope Worldwide of Canada on one side. And then this is just for you because you're leaving the best coast to go to the west coast. And on the left arm, there's a compass that has an N at the top and an S at the bottom, but that's not for north and south. It's for Nova Scotia. Just want to let you know that. So you'll wear it with pride, and no one else will know all that stuff, but you will. But it's great to have you in town, and sad to see you leave, but you're always welcome back. All right, our series, if you want to call it that. You know, last week did a lesson on does God exist, and today I'm kind of doing a part two of that. And the title of today's lesson is The Reality of God. But I wanted to start with a concept here called apologetics. Now, unfortunately for a lot of us, when we hear apologetics, we think of apologies. And unfortunately, we have far too many Christians who are too quick to say they're sorry for what they believe in and apologize versus being apologetic. We're making a defense to people for what they believe in. And it's very common today. Christians in the media and in your workplace and in school, we are now the targets of a lot of hatred. Now, you might say that's an overstatement. Well, I would just bear to say half of the things that are said about Christians and about Jesus were said about Muhammad and Allah, what would happen in your community. So, part of this issue that we wanted to look at is talking about apologetics, having a defense for our faith. Not merely saying I'm sorry because you don't need to be sorry, but being able to have a defense. We talked in 1 Peter last week about how Peter said we need to be prepared to give an answer for what we believe in. I've got a few things here I wanted to take a quick look at. The first purpose of apologetics is to validate the truth of Christianity. It involves employing philosophical arguments, empirical and historical evidence for the Christian faith. The goal, to develop a rational and reasonable case for Christianity against opposing beliefs and worldviews. There's a definition for apologetics. The purpose of it, to be prepared. Unfortunately, we live in an age where we're really looking for simplistic answers. We're looking for a quick fix. We search the web to answer life's toughest questions. And unfortunately, for all of us, most of us, if not all of us, we're usually looking for that quick fix, or we're looking for people who to tell us what we already believe. Rather than doing due diligence and digging down to find out, is this really true? C.S. Lewis. Christianity, if false, is of no importance. And if true, of infinite importance. The only thing it cannot be is moderately important. So if Christianity is true, it needs to be the most important thing in our life. If it's not true, we should completely disregard it. Because as Josh was sharing, on a cold, wet day like today, I'd much rather stay in bed under my blankets. I spent the entire evening getting my bed just to the right temperature, and then my alarm went off at 6 o'clock. I know no one can relate to that. But it can't be moderately important. Christianity is not designed to be a part of our life. It's designed to be our life. Back in the 1600s, men despise religion. They hate it and are afraid it may be true. The cure for this is first to show that religion is not contrary to reason, but worthy of reverence and respect. Next, make it attractive. Make good men wish it were true, and then show that it is. To show that religion and reason can work together, that we should set an example. Pascal's sharing this way back in the 1600s. And yet, Paul would write to a young man named Timothy, in 1 Timothy 4:16, and he'd say, watch your life and your doctrine closely. Persevere in them so you'll save both yourself and those who hear you. In other words, we need to know what we believe, and then we need to live it. And people will watch and see that example. Ravi Zacharias. The goal in most conflicts is to destroy your opponent. The goal in apologetics is to win your opponent. A couple of very prominent atheists today, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris. And Richard Dawkins' approach to anybody who is religious is if you meet them, mock them, embarrass them, ridicule them in front of people. In other words, there's a conflict, let's destroy your opponent. But as disciples of Jesus, our approach is to try to win them to what we believe to be true. Reality of God. Last week, I talked about a number of things. I shared three arguments that are often used for people who want to believe there is no existence of God. They're looking for empirical evidence. In other words, I'm a physical being. I want physical evidence there's a God. We talked about the comment that the first cosmonaut made when he got into space in 1961. Hey, I looked around intently for God, but didn't see him. Nobody's here. The problem is we're looking for physical evidence of a spiritual God. We talked about hypocrisy, which has infiltrated the church literally from day one. Go read the book of 1 Corinthians. Christians have struggled with this always. And so what happens is people will use that as an example. Well, hey, look, if you're a hypocrite, you believe this, don't live that, then why should I? And then there was the argument of an all-powerful and all-good God, then why is there evil? And I talked through that a little bit about, okay, so hold on, then there must be a standard of good and evil. And if we've all sinned, that would put us in the evil pile. And if you want God to remove all evil, then what happens to us? And so those were three, and again, I'm just reiterating last week. Then I talked about three considerations for the existence of God. The whole concept of physical reality. If we take the physical universe all the way back to point one, how did it start? And in and of itself, it cannot explain its cause. We talked about the first cause, or singularity. That something from outside had to begin, start it. We talked about being part of a universe of design. And the whole concept, I showed that picture of the McDonald's wrapper. And if you had stepped on a planet, and you saw that laying on the ground, and you saw this stuff that looks like letters and stuff, you'd assume some intelligent life was trying to communicate some kind of message, even if you didn't understand what it was. Yet we look at our universe and we wonder, how can it have such design? It must have just happened. Think about how more complex the universe is than a McDonald's wrapper. One of the books I've been reading recently talked about the story of if you were walking through the woods and saw a watch on the ground, would you think it just happened? And then the author who was writing that says, I understand the example of the analogy, but the person who made that analogy, they understand the ground and the grass that is under the watch is far more complex than the watch itself. And then we talked about moral reality. And how could matter plus time plus chance equal creation? How did that matter develop a conscience and develop moral understanding? And so that's sort of the lead into today. In the conclusion, I talked about the ultimate answer for evil is the cross. What is your worldview and how does it answer evil in our society? The cross does because it talks about, A, there being an eternity. B, we're going to have to give an accountability of our life someday. We can have forgiveness, which is so deep in all of us, whether we want to admit it or not. Those things that hurt our relationships, forgiveness, how that fixes it. God gives us a chance for a new beginning. And then we have the power of the Holy Spirit and the life of Christ to help us resist evil. So that, in a nutshell, was last week's lesson. Let's move on to this week. Ethics. What are they? Ethics are literally moral principles that guide our behavior and guide our life. And we also might term them as the values by which we live by. Last week, I shared, like I said, about an all-powerful God and all-good God and why there's evil. The question in and of itself raises the issue that we must have standards that define those terms. How do you determine what is good and what is evil? Simply put, evil is the corruption of good. So it implies we have a standard. Therefore, we must have a standard for good, and we call that a moral standard. Ethics, as I shared, is moral principles that govern our behavior. Are you with me so far, church? Again, this lesson, like last week, is going to be a little different. I'm going to leave you with some things to just really think about. If we are merely matter plus time plus chance that equals creation, then where did our morals, our ethics, and our values come from? Because we know good from evil, because we know right from wrong, it means there we must have a moral compass somewhere inside us. Moral standards that are inherent in our DNA. You know, I used the example last week of if you saw an eagle grab a baby goose and eat it, you would not think anything morally wrong there. It's part of nature. But if I went home and took an infant off the street and boiled it up and ate it for lunch, you'd have a problem with me doing that. Now, I know shock and awe, but why is that morally wrong? Yet we would think in nature, it's fine. Because there's a moral code in us of right and wrong. I propose to you this. This could not just merely happen by chance, this moral DNA. But it is given to us by a moral lawgiver, who I'm going to call the creator of our universe. Now, you might be thinking standards of good and evil, standards of right and wrong are all subjective. You know, what this nation thinks is right and wrong might be different than that nation, these people, those people. And that's a good question. And who are you to say what is right and wrong? But there are certain stages in our life, growing up, where you made decisions, I will never do, fill in the blank. And then as you get older, you cross that line. And I'll do this, but I'll never do that. And I think of things growing up, like I will never get drunk. And then all of a sudden you're hanging out with some of your friends. Maybe you're in your teens, maybe you're younger, and all of a sudden there's some beer, there's some liquor, and all of a sudden you cross that line. And then you start doing that more and more with your friends, but I will never do drugs. And before long you're smoking weed, but I'll never do anything else. And we keep pushing that barrier. I am never going to have sex until I'm married. But then all of a sudden you start crossing lines with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, and next thing, well, I'll never have intercourse. I'll do that, but I'll never do that. And then all of a sudden you're there. And we keep pushing the boundaries. And so it is a good question. Well, where are the standards? The Bible teaches in 1 Timothy 4, verse 1 through 2. If you have your Bible, turn with me there. This is a little side note. 1 Timothy 4, verse 1, it says, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in later times, some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and the teachings of demons." Verse 2. "Through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage." There's a principle here that says our conscience can be seared as with a hot iron. You know what searing is? If you went home and turned the burner on and took your finger and touched that red hot burner, it would hurt. And then all of a sudden, you'd get a blister, and that would break, and you touch it again, and that would hurt and blister, and you touch. And eventually, you'll kill all the nerve endings in your finger, and it'll get hard and callous to the point where you can touch it, and it doesn't bother you anymore. When we start crossing these moral lines in our life, we begin to do that to our heart, to the point where things that used to bother us no longer concern us. We'll cross whatever line. We don't care. It doesn't affect us. Our conscience has now been seared as with a hot iron. And then you know what we do? We gather around us a great number of people to tell us that it's okay. This example that I've talked through here, matter, time, chance equals creation. How did matter develop a conscience? When we talk about the things we've just shared about, I believe it's because there is a code written in our DNA from the beginning that there are basic concepts that we know are right and wrong. But as we grow up, we learn to change that boundary line to fit what we want. Let me approach this from a different perspective in my mind to help show the reality of God. What is one of the greatest values that we hold to? One of our greatest ethics, one of our greatest morals? Love. The greatest value is love. 80 to 90% of the songs, regardless of what genre you want to listen to, talks about that. Maybe higher. Maybe 95 to 99. Unless it's Christmas time and then, you know, grandma got run over by a reindeer. But that's all about love too. And I'm talking about love, not infatuation. Not using that word where love means I love pizza. But a deep love, an agape type love, a love that a parent would have for their child, a love that is self-denying, self-sacrificing, that has a deep longing deep in our heart. I think of examples of the love a mom will have for their children. I grew up in a broken home, single mom. And it amazed me what my mom did to make sure that I had a roof over my head, clothes on my back, and food. In the long hours and the shift work, all that stuff to try to take care of her child. I think of other stories that I've heard where moms have even gone through incredible situations, demeaning situations, just to make sure they could provide for their child. Where does that love come from? And what about fathers? Fathers who tend to get the short end of the stick, but I know a lot of fathers who will put themselves through very challenging situations with work, with bosses who humiliate them and embarrass them and try to demean them, but they're going to work because they want to provide for their family. You know, I once heard a statement, there are many men who can be dads, but there are very few who can be fathers. And you think of the love that it takes to be able to deny yourself those things to provide. Where does that come from? You know, human life has value. But how do you determine value for something? If I brought a 1-carat diamond out and put it right here in a bottle of water over there, what has more value? Right now, the diamond. But if I turn around and said, that's the last bottle of water on the planet, I'm going to auction it off. Those who own those diamonds are going to sell those diamonds to get money to try to get that bottle of water. How do we determine value? If we are merely a cosmic accident, why does human life have value? What's the difference between me saving your life and saving the life of that chipmunk running across the street? Why does human life have value? Why deep inside of us do we long to have these three questions answered? Where do I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? And every generation, regardless of how they term those questions, ask the same questions of their life. It's Jesus calling. Melva has a direct hotline to the Lord, so it's all okay. Melva, we're family. If we can't laugh at stuff, then who's going to laugh at it? Oh, it wasn't even Melva. Oh! That's on me. And this is recorded. My apologies, Melva. I just saw you reaching for stuff. and a little side note, but seriously, guys, we got to laugh more. Stuff happens in life. It's okay. And maybe it was Jesus calling. Who knows? Since you were such a respectful person and didn't answer it, we'll never know. But you think about this whole idea of if we're just an accident, then how do we determine value for a human life? And then on top of that, how do we answer these questions that plague us constantly? You know, the Bible in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and verse 11, says that God put the thoughts of eternity on our heart so that we would think beyond this life to something greater. And ultimately, I believe, to come to know Him. 1 John chapter 4, verse 9. How do you determine value for something? Well, what would you be willing to pay for it? This is how God showed His love among us. He sent His one and only Son into the world that we might live through Him. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that He loved us and sent His Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sin. You want to know how much value God has on your life? He was willing to sacrifice His Son for you. How many parents in this room are willing to sacrifice their child for somebody else? But God was willing to do that for us because He values us. He values you. He values me. God was willing to pay this price to redeem us. In other words, to gain or regain possession of something in exchange for a payment. God was willing to sacrifice His Son to redeem us because God sees the intrinsic value in each of us. Let me share it from this perspective. If God sees that value in you, if God sees that value in me, if God sees that value in the people you're going to come across today as you go about your life, then how should we look at one another? Because God values each and every life and was willing to sacrifice his son to pay for it. So should that not have an impact on how we live? Side note. Where does love come from? Well, in Genesis chapter 1, it says, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. So we are created in God's image. And God loves. And so when God created us, he created us in his image. So our DNA has those components in it. But as I shared last week, one of the components of love is the ability to have free will, to make choices, to decide what we want. What's really interesting when it comes to good and evil, right and wrong, we are determining and defining something based on what people do. A person. So maybe evil and wrong has to do with the choices we make and not so much God. Because God has given us free choice and we know what good is and what right is, but we choose not to. And so when we get mad at God for allowing evil, then what we're asking is, God, then take away our free will. Take away our ability to choose and just make us compliant to whatever you want. But God doesn't want to do that, because God wants us to love him because we want to, not because we have to. Life is about choices. 1 John chapter 4, verse 8, anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. So if God is love and we're created in God's image, then in our DNA is the ability to love. And with that is the ability to make choices. It's one of the examples of the scriptures. Over and over again, you see people and the choices they made. One of the reasons why I believe the Bible to be true versus other religious books, because the Bible doesn't whitewash anything. Hey, these are some of my top guys. I'm just going to paint them in the best light. No, no. David, who's a man after God's own heart, what did he do? When he was supposed to be off at war, he decided to stay home. Got out on the top of his castle and saw a woman bathing in the nude and goes, hey, why don't I bring her over and have sex with her? Oh, and then she gets pregnant. Well, let me call her husband, who's one of my mighty men, to come on back from the battle and go lay with his wife so we can cover it all up. He had more character than his king and would refuse to do that. So guess what David did? Let me write this little letter, seal it up, give it to Uriah, go back to the front line, give it to your commander. He opens up and says, I want you to put Uriah in the hottest point of the battle, and when the battle starts, pull everybody back and leave him there. Murdered him to hide his sin. Why does the Bible have that? Because we're all like that. And God doesn't want to cover up anything. This is who we are. But I still value you, and I'm going to send my child to die in your place so that you can make a choice to love me. God is love. We're made in God's image. Our moral standards are not just by mere chance. There's no cosmic rolling of the dice. But they are impacted into our DNA by the very designer and creator who's made everything. In conclusion, evil is the corruption of good. Lies are the corruption of truth. We must first define what good is and what truth is before you can define what evil and lies are. We have moral standards. The problem with our moral standards today is they're a moving target. Based on cultural consensus. Well, what does our society today want to define marriage as? What does our society today want to define gender as? What does our society today want to define? You can fill in the blank. Well, that's a consensus, so that is now the definition. Definitions that have been a part of our planet for millennia are now being defined based on how I feel, what I want. And we're paying a price for it. But that's a lesson for a different day. Our moral standards are becoming a moving target. Moral definitions have guided humanity for millennia are being disregarded. If there is a day of accountability, then we need to be aware of our choices. You know, Solomon, the son of David, who'd become an incredibly powerful, wealthy king who was able to do anything he wanted. You take all the wealth of Warren Buffett. You can take all the wealth of every billionaire you know, compile it all together, and it still didn't match what Solomon had. And so the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon writes, and he shares everything he did. You name it, he did it. Pursued pleasure to try to find fulfillment in life. Pursued education, fulfillment. He did it all. And when it was all said and done, turn me over to Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13 and 14. Says, now all has been heard, and here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So here's a person who was able to do whatever he thought he did. And when it was all said and done, he said, listen, here's the whole duty of mankind. Fear God. Obey his commandments. We have value. I wanted to read a story. And then after that, Lorenzo is going to come forward and lead our hearts in prayer as we take communion. It says, an ugly green chair sat on top of a trash pile, awaiting the arrival of a garbage truck. Those who passed by saw the chair, thought to themselves, I don't blame those people for throwing that hideous chair away. In fact, I wonder why it took them so long. However, one person had an entirely different reaction when he passed by and saw the chair. Quickly pulled his station wagon over to the curb, jumped out, grabbed the chair, put it in the back of his vehicle and drove away. When this antique dealer got the chair home, he began stripping off the many coats of paint until he was down to the original wood. Once restored, this chair was a thing of beauty and value. To the eyes of the unaware, the chair was junk. But to the trained eye of an antique dealer, it was an object to be esteemed. The layers of ugly paint did not take away the basic nature of the chair underneath it all. Similarly, we have painted our lives with many ugly coats of sin. But the real value remains underneath the surface. Once the blood of Christ removes that hideous layers, our true natures may be seen once more. But what is it about our natures that give us value in the first place? It is what we have made. It is that we were made in the image of God Himself. We have the capability to reason, to feel, to appreciate, to love, and we have the capacity to live for eternity. But how can we be sure that we are that valuable? Our value has been permanently established by the price God paid for us. You know, as we take communion today, I wanted to share with us again that story. We've all made choices in our life that have tarnished our lives, have covered us to hide our value. But God knows our true value and paid an incredible price to redeem us. We just need to make choices to accept what God has done for us and then to follow Him as our Creator. We take communion every week, not because we're commanded to. In fact, we're told to take communion whenever we want. But when you do it, to remember the sacrifice of Jesus. And I think sometimes we can take communion and lose touch with what it's really all about. And the fact is that we are incredibly valuable people in God's eyes, and paid an incredible price for us. And communion is a time to remember that and connect our hearts to God so that we can clean away last week and look forward to marching into the week ahead. This time, if I could have Lorenz come forward, let us prepare to pray as we take communion.